Salve and salutations. My name is Charles Chestnut, this is Storied History, and this story is the long-delayed conclusion of my series on the history of Mexico. Right off the bat, I do want to apologize for how long this was delayed. I know this was supposed to be up in June, and it is now October. I had a series of medical issues that had to be dealt with that kind of took me out of commission, and I just took a few months off. Life is what it is. Life happens. And although sometimes people don't think it be like it is, but it do. I am going to start making these again, probably on a schedule of about once a month, maybe twice a month if I have a good idea or put out a smaller one. That and I have begun Twitch streaming, so if you know what that is, yes, Storied History is on Twitch, and I am playing single-player games, commenting on the games themselves. I'm doing some of the more amusing ones and interesting ones, The Witcher, South Park, The Stick of Truth, Days Gone, that sort of things. So I'll be commenting on the history, the lore, mythology, what have you, around the games themselves. I'm not doing PvP because I'm not good at it and I don't really enjoy it. But we would love to have you stop by on Twitch. It is Storied History on Twitch. And yeah, throw me a little message, say hello, make fun of me. That's all fine. Oh, one other point. This is for Dan Rand, a friend of mine. He told me that when I saw him on the Appalachian Trail, that he couldn't understand what I was saying in the beginning. Salve and salutations. Salve is Latin. It just means hello. So salutations is a generic greeting. So basically salve and salutations means hello and hello. So that's for you, Dan. Thanks for listening, buddy. See you at Trail Days. So we are finally here, and here's where we are. It's the end of the Mexican Revolution, so let me explain. No, there is too much. Let me sum up. Pancho Villa is a gentleman bandit in the north, and Emiliano Zapata is a land-reforming revolutionary in the south. Both of them supported a weird guy named Madero, who believed that the spirits had told him he was going to be president. The spirits were right about that. They were wrong about pretty much everything else. It wasn't a long and successful presidency. He was overthrown in a coup organized by the American ambassador, who was not acting under the authority of the American government. He was acting on his own. That is the evil Henry Lane Wilson, the U.S. ambassador to Mexico. He put a new dictator on the throne, who then executes Madero, the duly elected president of Mexico. Wilson almost ended up in prison for doing this in the United States, but was able to avoid prosecution. But his vile deeds had long-lasting consequences. The execution of Madero drove his supporters Pancho Villa and Emiliano Zapata to rebel against the new dictator, which they do, and they are successful. This time, they rally around another guy, the man to rally around, the politician du jour, or politician de dia, I guess, the politician of the day, is a guy named Carranza. He is a constitutionalist who mainly wants a Mexican constitution. And they are headed toward Mexico City. Pancho Villa from the north, Emiliano Zapata from the south. They get there, and the new dictator, Huerta, was overthrown. He flees. There was some action taken where he was going to try to draw his supporters from around the United States and invade Mexico from Texas, but he gets arrested in Texas and dies 6 months later. How did he die? Well, he was an extraordinarily heavy drinker, like the radically, radically heavy drinkers, the kind of person that if you're going to get off alcohol, you have to be under a doctor's care or you could die. And while he was sitting in prison, he got off alcohol without a doctor's care. Now, is that what actually happened to him? We're not entirely sure, but it certainly didn't help. It contributed to his demise. So on to more pleasant and unfortunately temporarily happy things. Carranza is in Mexico City. Pancho Villa has come from the north, Emiliano Zapata from the south. And I would just like to say this about Pancho Villa right now, as a description of the man himself. This is a quote that was written by an American journalist who was embedded with Pancho Villa's forces. He said of Pancho, "He is the most natural human being I have ever saw. Natural in the sense of being nearest to a wild animal. He says almost nothing and seems so quiet as to be almost diffident if he isn't smiling. He looks gentle, all except his eyes, which are never still and full of energy and brutality." That is a cool description. So in the last episode, I talked about how just before Pancho Villa had reached Mexico City, Carranza sent him off to attack another city. It's possible that Carranza was worried that he, having entered Mexico City, would then attempt to take control or possibly take the presidency himself. And I don't think he would have. I really don't. Because, and this is a direct quote from Pancho Villa about whether or not he should be president, "The country must be governed by someone who really loves his people and his land, who shares wealth and progress. I have all that, only that I am ignorant." This is a man who knows his own limitations and was not shy or embarrassed about admitting his lack of education and his own just ignorance to the world. So he, and I take him at his word, I really do for that. So he didn't want to be president, but he also didn't want Carranza to be president. So basically, and this is just incredibly simplified, Carranza calls for a constitutional convention, but he refused to adopt the land reform. Remember that? It always goes back to the land reform that Emiliano Zapata put forward. Without the land reform, Pancho Villa and Zapata break with Carranza, so Carranza is now alone. Or rather, he would be alone, but he does have one ally, Obregón. And Obregón is in charge of the military, so Carranza has the army. So you've got Carranza and the military on one side, and you've got Emiliano Zapata and Pancho Villa on the other. And they had only been allies because they had united against a common enemy. It's exactly the same thing that happened against the dictator Diaz. All of these disparate groups united to overthrow him, and they were successful. But once they did, they couldn't fully agree on who's going to be running the country and how it was going to be run. And most importantly, what was going to happen to the land. The enemy of my enemy is not necessarily my friend once that enemy is defeated. So the temporary alliance breaks. Again, first they broke with Madero, and then they break with Carranza. Carranza flees, Pancho Villa and Emiliano Zapata attack Mexico City in December 1914. And they are successful. So now the peasant leaders of the peasant armies can walk the corridors of power, which they do. But even though they're in the corridors of power, they don't really want the power. The two of them really were focused on their regions, not the country as a whole, and certainly not international relations. Villa is in the north, Zapata is in the south, and of course land reform is the biggest issue. Neither one of them has any interest in actually trying to run the entire country of Mexico. So here is another direct quote from Pancho Villa on that note, on that issue. "I am a fighter, not a statesman. I am not educated enough to be president. I only learned to read and write properly 2 years ago. How could I, who never went to school, hope to be able to talk to the foreign ambassadors and the cultivated gentlemen of Congress? It would be bad for Mexico if an uneducated man were to be president." That is a fantastic quote, and it is phenomenally insightful into Pancho Villa's thought processes and psyche. He was not a narcissist who believed that he was capable of absolutely anything and everything all of the time. He recognized his own limitations, and he also recognized that the real world, which is that you have to deal with the other countries, and specifically, you have to deal with the United States and with the politicians in the United States, and maybe you have to deal with an incredibly evil U.S. ambassador, although the evil Henry Layden Wilson is gone at this point. He realized he was not up to this task, and he didn't want it. So, they say power is attractive, and it really is. And the lust for power can be pervasive and all-consuming. But he just didn't have it. He wanted what was best for his country and literally said, hey, it's not going to be me. I respect that. I really do. I deeply do. Zapata and Pancho Villa both believed that a more educated man should be the president, and they actually wanted someone from the middle class. They did not want an uneducated peasant, and they also didn't think it would be a good idea to have another super wealthy landowner, for obvious reasons. And they also didn't just want another general. So they supported a new guy. The new guy is called Gutierrez, and they called him the interim president of Mexico. But the problem with that is that there already is an interim president of Mexico, and that's Carranza. So now there's two governments in Mexico, both claiming to be legitimate, which means that the Mexican Revolution is now a Mexican Civil War. So the next five episodes of the podcast will be covering that. No, not really. Definitely not. I'm not doing this again. This is the last episode about the history of Mexico. I'm not doing any more deep dives into Mexican history, although I am going to do one about the biography of a drug lord, which is going to be great later on. So this portion actually gets up fairly quickly wrapped up, at least for this podcast. So while they're just kind of sitting there in Mexico City, there are advisors and supporters in the peasant armies urging the leaders to go and attack the regular Mexican army and Carranza, who are basically a few hundred miles away, just sitting in Veracruz, which is a city on the shore, the Gulf of Mexico. And they don't do it. And the main reason that they don't do it is because they were worried about leaving their strongholds of power. Because at that point, Pancho Villa had been winning all these battles in the north, and the same thing with Zapata in the south, but now both of them are operating outside their home bases, so to speak. They're together, and they're successful, but they didn't want to leave Mexico City, and legitimately so, because that is the seat of power for Mexico, and it has been for centuries. And for centuries before Mexico was Mexico. You walk away from there, someone else can take the city, take the capital, and declare themselves to be the new president. So they didn't do it. And because they didn't do it, they gave General Obregón and Carranza time to rebuild their forces. And they do. If they had struck quietly and quickly, Pancho Villa and Zapata probably could have defeated the remnants of the Mexican army, but they didn't. So all the remnants came back together. They coalesced, or recoalesced, I suppose, as the case may be. They reformed, reorganized, and rearmed in Veracruz. And if they had left Mexico City, the next thing would not have happened, and that is the big split. Villa and Zapata's bandits, peasant soldiers, were getting up to a lot of trouble. They were stealing, they were fighting, they were getting too drunk, they were carousing with the ladies. They really didn't have... these two leaders really didn't have a lot of control over their own bandit soldiers. So everything just kind of comes to a head. It's too much. There is a split. And the new split sends Gutierrez to join Carranza. So just to sum up, Carranza splits with Pancho Villa and Emiliano Zapata. Then Villa and Zapata place a new guy in charge, and now it's a civil war. They refuse to attack Carranza at his stronghold, and then the new guy splits with them and goes to join Carranza. So both interim presidents are now on the same side, and along with the Mexican army and the people who are on the out, is Pancho Villa and Zapata. I realize it's a little bit complicated, but if you think about it, it's just the same thing that happens three times. First, it's Madero being supported by Villa and Zapata, and he turns on them. They turn on him, and now he's all alone. Then it was Carranza being supported by Villa and Zapata, and then he turns on them, and they turn on him, and now he's by himself, and then they support Gutierrez, and then he turns on them, so they turn on him. It happened three times. So the forces are divided, and Obregón and Carranza, now with the support of Gutierrez, are in Veracruz. They have rearmed, reorganized, and reconstituted their forces. So what they do is attack Mexico City. And they are successful. Villa and Zapata are driven out. The peasant armies are now divided. Villa goes back to the north. Zapata goes back to the south. So the first thing that the successful New Mexican army does is attack Pancho Villa. And when they do, they get the full support of the United States. Almost, not quite. They have to actually defeat Villa decisively before the U.S. will throw their full support. And this is one of those really weird attacks, one of those strange battles where both sides are just absolutely at their last limit. Whoever wins this is going to win everything because both sides are drained and defeated, beaten down. This is it. Whoever wins this is going to win the whole thing. Obregón, the general of the Mexican army, said, "We have supplies only for tomorrow, and our limited ammunition is only enough to take a town by assault. Aguas Calientes, it is impossible to retreat because there's not enough ammunition or provisions, and because it would be very irksome, I am perfectly aware of the risks. I am taking all our men and will begin the advance on Aguas Calientes at dawn tomorrow. With hopes, but little assurance given our ammunition shortages, of occupying the town." They've got one shot left. Pancho Villa has been defeated, and now he's hiding in this town with the remnants of his soldiers, but at the same time, Obregón's men, they've only got one more attack in them. And they've got to attack the town because there is ammunition, and more importantly, food, because they've also run out of food. They've got one day's left of rations. This is it. If they lose, or if they don't attack, then Villa could counterattack with his starving men at the end of their rope and possibly turn them over to his side. Maybe. Starving men do very strange things. I mean, it's also often been said humanity is four meals away from barbarism, and that is fairly true. So this gambit, this all-or-nothing roll of the dice, pays off. The fighting was fairly brutal, and General Obregón lost his arm, but they were successful. They take the town, they're able to restock and rearm themselves, and they have dealt Pancho Villa his decisive defeat. So they offered him a truce, and he refuses. Villa says no. He goes back, he escapes, and he goes back to continuing his guerrilla warfare. Zapata in the south was basically being left alone while they're focusing on the Villa in the north. And Zapata had proved that he was not comfortable operating outside of his home state in the south, so the Mexican military really did not have to try to pin him down. All they had to do was to leave him alone, and he would stay there, and that's exactly what they did, and that's exactly what he did. It was at this point that the United States becomes involved again. The last time that we had been involved was in officially supporting Madero to help him ascend to the presidency at the very beginning of this whole Mexican Civil War. Over the ensuing years and fighting, they had supported one faction or another. They had supported these guys, then those guys, and sometimes other guys at the same time. And they were selling weapons to a bunch of different people, including Pancho Villa. He had been supplied and sold weapons by the United States. But now that he has lost that rather final decisive battle, Woodrow Wilson, the President of the United States, is much more concerned with the wider war than the Mexican Civil War, and that is World War I. It has really just begun, and he really wants peace in Mexico because he doesn't want to have to worry about what's happening on the southern border while the United States is about to go to war in Europe. And that is a perfectly understandable and reasonable position. So Wilson, the United States, supports the official president of Mexico, Carranza. He recognizes it and, in other words, says, "Yes, you are the official president." Villa gets very angry. And so in retaliation for Woodrow Wilson recognizing Carranza, Pancho Villa attacks the United States. Sort of. He's a bandit. He's not going to invade the United States. He's going to raid a town. A town that happened to have several hundred United States Army soldiers, mainly cavalry, and some infantry stationed there. They were planning on stealing the horses, is what they were going to try to do, and get as much ammunition as they can because they had been disarmed when they'd lost that fight that I just covered. It didn't work. The United States cavalry, the 300 cavalrymen, rallied, returned fire, and they defeated Villa and the bandits. The final casualties, 17 on the American side and 100 of Pancho Villa's raiders. This was fairly one-sided. It was also extraordinarily out of character for Pancho Villa. Not the raiding, because he had done that many, 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 many times in Mexico. It was doing it in America that was so out of character, and really nobody knows why. There's basically three theories. One is that he was very angry about Wilson recognizing the Carranza government of Mexico, and this was his revenge. Two, he had a personal grudge against an arms dealer in the town, and so this was about that. And three, that he was trying to spark a war between the United States and Mexico, because he thought that if the United States government declared war on Mexico, then the people would rally again, the country would be unified, and he would be once again in a position of power and influence. It's possible. Really, all three of those are good theories, and I do not know which one to point to and say, hey, this is it. So it's possible it was a mixture of all three, but for whatever reason that he did it, he definitely did it. And it did fail. And then after that, Wilson did not attack. President Woodrow Wilson was a very conscientious man. He was very pragmatic. He was not quick to anger, which is not something, that irrational rage is not something you want in a leader, especially not one in charge of an army. And so Wilson was not prone to rash decisions, and so he does not declare war on Mexico. Instead, he sends a general, General Blackjack Pershing, south to attack Pancho Villa, but only to attack Pancho Villa, not to declare war on Mexico. He does not declare war on Villa. He does not declare war on Mexico. He declares war on Villa. And he actually has the official support of Carranza, the government in Mexico City. Unofficial support. They are very quietly looking the other way so that this invasion, this incursion on Mexican soil by the United States Army is not looked upon as an act of war, more like a police action. Pershing fails. That incursion was a complete disaster for a bunch of different reasons that really don't matter, but the primary one was that everybody in his home state loved Pancho Villa, and they didn't help the Americans at all. They were able to fight him and wound him at one point, but just the one point, but then he got away. And because he continued to evade them, Pancho Villa became more and more famous. Now, at this point, Carranza, the president, is becoming impatient with the hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of U.S. soldiers operating in Mexico, about 250 miles into Mexico. So his patience runs out, and the Americans turn around, and they go back home. Their expedition was a failure. And they leave. And this, by the way, this isn't short. This was not a small, quick thing. This is more than a year that a U.S. Army was operating in Mexico. It's not a small thing. It's not a quick thing. But it was a impotent and futile attempt. Again, just to close that with a amusing little note from General Pershing after the failure. Every time he or his soldiers had asked for the whereabouts of Villa, they always got the same answer. He's over there. He's over that hill. And when they were to go to investigate, he never was. So Pershing sent a message to President Wilson. It is my duty to inform you that Pancho Villa is both everywhere and nowhere. And it is at this point that one of the more infamous pieces of World War I history rears its head, the Zimmermann Telegram. This was an official document that had been sent from Germany during World War I to Mexico, asking them to declare war on the United States. And what they had promised was that after the war was over and Germany becomes the new rulers of the world, that they would support Mexico in recovering Texas, Arizona, and New Mexico. And California, all the way up to, well, all of what used to be New Spain, basically. Pretty much everything they had lost over the centuries, they were going to get back. This really made the United States very, very angry. Understandably so. And Carranza did not immediately reject it. Instead, he looked into it. He examined it. He questioned his generals. How would that work? Would it work at all? And how could we hold it? And all of the generals in Mexico said, no, no, that is not going to work. You are going to lose. If you try to do this, it is not a question of whether or not it will work. The question is how quickly it will fail. Because even if it did work temporarily, we're not going to be able to hold it very long. And at this point, because we're talking about 1917, we're not talking about 1717. There is a absolutely huge population in the western half of the United States. This is decades after the massive move westward had happened, all the pioneers, everything. The railroads had been in place for also many decades. There is millions, huge populations in the western half of the United States that would have rebelled against Mexico because they wanted to be Americans. They were not going to tolerate Mexico taking over California, Texas, New Mexico, Arizona, Colorado, Utah, simply because Germany said that they could. It wasn't going to work, even if it would have been possibly temporarily successful, although really spectacularly unlikely. So all of the generals said, no, this is not going to work, don't do it. And Carranza pragmatically agrees with them and says, yeah, we're not gonna do that. Carranza tells Germany, no. So Mexico remained neutral in World War I. The Americans declared war on Germany, and well, that's another story. I'm not going into that. So instead of trying to fight the United States, Carranza looks at the situation and he realizes that Zapata is pretty much confined to his home state voluntarily. Pancho Villa has been defeated, and now he's going to consolidate his hold on power. But he's not a dictator. This isn't Huerta trying to consolidate through force. No, what Carranza does is what he always said that he would do from the very beginning. He is a constitutionalist. So he puts forward a constitution. And this is the Mexican Constitution of 1917. And it's designed to end the fighting. What he's trying to do is to appeal to everybody. He's trying to come up with compromises on all of the big issues so that the fighting would stop. Finally, there would be peace. This new constitution did cover land reform. Maybe not to the extent that Zapata had wanted, but it is there. There are things that appeal to everybody, although nobody got everything that they wanted. It includes maternity leave. It includes equality of pay and a minimum wage. So he really is attempting to appeal to the peasant class to support the new constitution. Now, because it did actually give them some things that the peasants wanted, it was blocked temporarily, opposed rather than blocked. It was not blocked, it was opposed, of course, by the very, very wealthy, the landowners, the haciendas, who wanted to continue their absolute control and power and, well, wealth. But they were unsuccessful. It was adopted officially in February 1917, and it became the Constitution of Mexico. Carranza has then consolidated his power, so he turns his eyes south. And the Mexican army then begins to attack Zapata, who still wanted radical, pervasive land reform. But at this point, because the Constitution had passed and because there really is no more appetite for destruction in the peasant classes, it's just not going to work. Everybody's exhausted and tired. It's not going to happen. Although Zapata did fight bravely, he did win some victories, they were defeated. And towards the end of that fighting, Zapata was desperate for allies. He was going to go down fighting. He was not going to go quietly into the night. He really was trying to find anybody they could to support him. And it wasn't just soldiers that they needed. They needed weapons. They needed ammunition. And in his desperation, he turned to a colonel in the Mexican army, a man named Jesus Gardo. And Gardo had been arrested for being drunk and rowdy and fighting and other things in a cantina. And while he's arrested, Zapata believes that maybe this is his man. Maybe this is his guy. They've got some mutual friends, and maybe he can be convinced to switch sides. So Zapata contacts, or rather tries to contact, Jesus. He sends him a note inviting him to switch sides. The note is intercepted, and instead of going to Jesus, it goes to the desk of the general who had been ordered to defeat Zapata. So the general calls in Jesus and is berating him, yelling, screaming, "You are a disgrace, you are a drunk, you are a traitor." He's threatening him with exile and death. Jesus is crying. He ends up being reduced to tears. And when he is at his last moments, when he believes he cannot survive this, that he may be executed by this general, who, you know, he had the authority, power to do that, the general offers him a deal. But he says, "If you assist me in defeating Zapata, then you will regain your honor." So the little broken colonel, Jesus, writes to Zapata and tells him that he will bring over all of his troops, his men, his soldiers, his weapons, his provisions, his ammunition, everything. And that they would support and join the Zapatistas in their continued struggle. Zapata agrees to all of the terms and conditions that Jesus put forward, primarily involving his own power and authority. Zapata believed that Jesus was just another soldier trying to get as much for himself as he could. And he played into that. In order to prove his loyalty, Zapata had ordered Jesus to attack a small federal garrison. And they do. They do attack. And it's fake. All of it. It's fake. It's a battle, but it's a fake battle. It literally is just pretend. It was staged on April 9th. The soldiers on both sides knew what was happening. They shot over the heads of the opposing, attacking, defending soldiers. They actively tried not to hurt each other. But there was a lot of gunfire. And it was not obvious that it was fake. So by the end, the attackers, quote-unquote attackers, are driven off. Zapata is convinced that Jesus is dealing with him fairly and honestly. And so he does finally agree to meet with him and to finalize the defection. And then they would accept him into his army with all the provisions and weapons. On April 10th, 1919, Jesus Gallardo invited Emiliano Zapata to a meeting. When Zapata arrives, he was immediately attacked as soon as he walked through the door and was executed right on the spot. There was no negotiation, there was no trial, there was no gloating, no pleading, or discussion. He was simply killed right then and there. And the little revolutionary, who had so desperately wanted just that one thing, land reform, did not live to see it happen. Zapata's body was on display for 24 hours and then buried. Many, many pictures had been taken that could be distributed across the country so the people would know that Zapata, at long last, had been killed. There had been some successes. Zapata did get some land reform, but it was in the Constitution of 1917. That was the extent of the land redistribution. It did take some of the land that had been stolen under the Diaz dictatorship and returned it to the rightful owners. But the larger scale redistribution that he wanted did not occur. And his legacy? Well, Zapata is remembered as one of the most revered heroes of Mexican history. To a huge number of Mexicans and people around the world, Emiliano Zapata was a true revolutionary, one that truly, honestly, and fervently was trying to fight for the rights and for the prosperity of the peasant class, to give voice to the voiceless and power to the powerless. He was an idealist who could not be bribed, could not be corrupted, and one that had succeeded in two revolutions, but in the end did not achieve his ultimate goal. And the land reform that did exist did not come from him, it came from Carranza. Thus endeth Zapata. So, Carranza has been victorious. That's the end, right? No, definitely not. Although we are very, very close. You and I are rapidly approaching the end. Carranza was in an untenable situation. The economy had been absolutely destroyed by 10 years of war. The people are starving, and now he's losing his allies. Obregón, the general who defeated Pancho Villa, was now calling for Carranza to step down, which he refused to do so, and in the end, one of his own soldiers shot him to death while he was asleep in his bed. The primary reason that the shooter gave was that he was tired of running and hiding from other members of the army, and that the warfare had to end. In the north, Villa and Obregón renew hostilities. They start fighting again. Now they are fighting each other, and for a little while, they are successful. Pancho Villa's last major military action was a raid against Ciudad Juarez in 1919, but after that, his successes were very few and far between, and small and becoming smaller. And his men, his best men, his closest advisors and friends, they started to become captured and killed in the fighting. But at that point, this had been going on for so long that neither side wanted warfare. Pancho Villa just didn't want to do this anymore, and his men didn't want to do it anymore. So they struck a truce. It's not a surrender, but it's a ceasefire that was permanent. Pancho Villa would step down. He would officially retire. He would no longer be a bandit leader. He would no longer be a general. Instead, he would retire to a very large hacienda. 25,000 acres. Which probably would have made Emiliano Zapata very, very angry. And who knows what would have happened then. But Zapata is gone at this point. And Pancho Villa, the last man standing from the leaders of the original revolution, accepts the deal. He retires to his very, very large estate. There is a general amnesty declared for him and his bandits, for the soldiers. The amnesty held and the people dispersed. They went to their homes in Mexico and to new places in the United States, to new lives. Just as a side note, one of the most popular Mexican restaurants in Houston, Texas, for decades was called Leo's Mexican Restaurant. and he was a veteran of the Mexican Revolution that had fought in both the regular Mexican army and then for Pancho Villa. And that's his picture that I'm used for the episode art. That's the original Leo. He was very proud of what he had done, would talk about that for anyone that would listen. His time in the Mexican military and under Villa. So Pancho Villa lives. The last remaining 200 guerrillas, the bandits, would live with him. They are still loyal to him. They would reside in his new hacienda, and they would even get a pension paid by the Mexican government. Of these 200, there were 50 or so that maintained horses. They would remain his small cavalry. They were assigned new roles as his personal bodyguards, and they would go on little expeditions to go around the hacienda, inspect the fences, that sort of thing, make sure that no one was going to attack, and then if Villa ever left his stronghold, they would go with him. So in the end, Pancho retires to a quiet life in Chihuahua for a few years. But in 1923, President Obregón, the last man standing, decides that he wants to be the last man standing and decides to take decisive and somewhat divisive action. Usually, Pancho had been accompanied by his 50 bodyguards, but for some unknown reason, and it really is unknown, we don't know, that day he had gone into town without them. And instead of taking his 50 men, he took three. He goes into town on July 20th, 1923, without his bodyguards. He passes a little school and a small market, and a little agricultural vendor runs toward the car, yelling, "Viva, Villa, Viva, Villa." That was the signal to a group of seven riflemen, who then appeared in the middle of the road and fired more than 40 rounds into the little automobile that he was driving. Pancho Villa was killed instantly. His bodyguard, well, two of them died, one survived. They managed to kill one of the assassins, and then the surviving guy fled. So in the end, that part of the story, that part of the song that I sang in the very beginning of the first episode, it was accurate. That is actually how it happened. When Pancho met his match, you know, on the deserts down in Mexico. Nobody heard his dying words. But that's the way it goes. His funeral was huge. Thousands of grieving supporters followed the casket to the burial site. The six surviving assassins were out hiding in the desert. They were soon captured. Two of them served a few months in jail. The rest, nothing. And in the end, it was Obregón, the president, for a few years. And then by the end of 1928, he was killed as well. Assassinated once again. We're not covering that. But the new president after him founded the National Revolutionary Party. This is the official party of the revolution, even though it was founded more than 10 years after the revolution was over by the guy that had killed the last member of the revolution. But, you know, whatever. And it was basically the only power in Mexico, a one-party state, not exactly, but very close to it, until the year 2000. So in the end, what happened? Well, the dictatorships were broken. The people did receive the land that had been stolen from them, some of them, and some of the land. The extraordinarily brutal treatment of the peasants had pretty much stopped. That was one of the side effects of all this, was that the people that rose up when they were abused to such an extreme degree, they weren't really abused after that to such an extreme degree. Squeezed, maybe, but not crushed. The power of the hacienda owners had been broken. They were no longer allowed or even capable of blocking the social reforms within their own lands. There were schools built across the country. The middle class enjoyed expanded freedoms and rights. Some things changed, some stayed the same. There were heroes and villains, there was courage and cowardice, there were victories and defeats, and strawberry soda. There were stories to be told, songs to be sung, there were legends that grew into myths, and tales that faded from memory. There were truly unique individuals that led amazing lives, burned out quickly, and left their mark on the country of Mexico and its people. And in the end, was it all worth it? I don't know. But it sure makes a great story. All right, that will do it for the history of Mexico. I am going to do an episode, probably one, maybe two, on a drug lord. The only drug lord that actually wrote his own autobiography. And he doesn't really pull any punches about a lot of the things he did. And he was a Mexican drug lord. We're not talking about the guys in South America. And he's a throwback. This is not one of the more modern drug lords that, you know, the men of forever, the Cali cartel, or very sophisticated. Nope, this guy was a smuggler from a smuggling family that turned into a smuggler with a lot of power. His name is Pablo Acosta, and I am definitely going to do a little bit about his, just kind of a biography version. I don't think I'm going to do any of the really complex stories again. This Mexican Revolution became so complex with so many different people and so many different moving parts that it's very, very hard to put into a coherent and simplified in quick way. So I'm going to pass on those. Probably. Who knows? I am, as I said at the beginning of this episode, I am now Twitch streaming, and you can find me on Twitch if you search for Storied History. So twitch.tv, do a search for Storied, Storied, History, and I will pop up. I've just started, so there's really... I don't have a lot of followers. The other day, I was doing streaming for about 2 hours, kind of talking to myself for those 2 hours. But I do have some hopes, and I actually enjoyed it. So I will continue to do that. The very next episode is going to be about something I find absolutely incredibly fascinating, and that is the legends and the stories and the possibility that the Pacific Islanders actually crossed the Pacific Ocean well before Columbus. The voyagers crossing the ocean, a much larger ocean than the Atlantic Ocean. There is new evidence that they did, and it's really cool the way that legends on both sides match up. It's really neat. So I'm going to cover that. And that will be released in November before, or maybe around the time that Moana 2 is released in theaters. Because, hey, I can do synchronicity like the best of them. I'm looking forward to that one. Okay, that does wrap it up for me. If you haven't hit the subscribe button, please do so. I again want to apologize for the massive delay, the several months since this one was supposed to have come out, but, you know, life happens. And I said it at the beginning of the episode, I'll say it again. People don't think it be like it is, but it do.
Storied History is written and recorded by Charles Chestnut in New Orleans, Louisiana, with audio production and original music by Seamus O'Connor. If you enjoyed it, please subscribe, and we'll see you soon.